Well, here we are.
It makes me laugh every time.
Here we are.
Even when we're not playing it.
Even when we're not playing it.
I'm just thinking about it in my
head.
Just
thinking, yeah, we're mentally picturing the scream that we'll add later. But yes, I don't even know what where we're coming from and where we're going
this
to.
This is so confusing. So
we're out of time.
We're in a bookworm hole.
We are in a bookworm hole.
Yeah. So this episode that we're doing right now is the correct episode of the sequence, but it's really going to seem out of place because people, if they listen, will have heard Dexter.
Both of you have listened.
We'll have heard Dexter and then the MD.
Then the MD.
And then this one. But it's only in Dexter that we talk about reading this book. So people should be ahead.
Yeah, because we're not going to post this until after the MD.
It's only that the MD people don't know they should have read Dexter.
Yeah. Nobody reads these books.
You do, and I do, usually.
That's about it.
That, and sometimes that's suspect.
Yeah. Yeah. I can fake it. I made it through graduate school by reading just the back covers of books.
So when they basically know what they're going to do.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Anyway.
So what are we reading this week?
Well, we are reading Adrian Ross's The Pit, The Hole of the Pit.
The Hole of the Pit. Now, I will be very surprised. Very surprised indeed if anybody out there has read this book. If you have, you are among an elite few, because this book is freaking impossible to find.
Well, let's give a little history of this book. What we're speaking of is not a book that you can't go into Amazon and type in Adrian Ross, Hole of the Pit, and find a book with that title, because that was only published once in 1914, and just one edition, and it's impossible to find. I mean, it's unspeakably rare. It's
like, on its own.
It's like a Gutenberg Bible. Yeah. On its own. Yeah. But it was reprinted for the first time in 80 years, in the early 90s, mid 90s, in a collection from Warner Books.
1992.
Edited by Ramsey Campbell. And this is the one that we'll put, we'll get an image of this book and put it up on the webpage. And with any luck, it'll show up on your little podcast, iPod-y picture thingy. It was a book edited by Ramsey Campbell called Uncanny Banquet, Great Tales of the Supernatural.
Ooh.
And because the Hole of the Pit is in this book too has become kind of hard to find. Because collectors, people who are interested in this sort of thing, myself included, go out and snarf this kind of stuff up. And so I gone and snarfed up a copy of it. The main reason it's so hard to find, it was never released in America. That's the problem. If you're in Canada or in Britain or even Australia, you probably will have an easier time finding it. But in America, we have to pay import prices based off of pounds sterling, which is
expensive. But if somebody wants to buy the hardcover one and send it to me, I'd be happy to take it.
Sure.
Because these are the hardcovers, the ones with
suspenders. Yeah, the hardcovers. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of hardcovers. There's actually signed hardcovers you can find out there. But, you know, you go up on ABE Books and, you know, the cheapest copy you can find is like $30. Plus, you have to pay the shipping. So the book is findable. You have to probably have to pony up some scratch. But, and maybe we'll talk about this later, we have some nefarious plans about this book that we're sort of forming and debating. So stay tuned. So anyway, I found a copy of this book.
You did?
Yeah, we were actually
shared it.
Yeah, we shared it. We you know,
that's our first book sharing.
Oh, it was very sweet. Normally, when we sit back and give you a synopsis of an entire book, it's because
we're vamping because
we don't know what to say. But out of courtesy this time, because you probably won't have read it, we will give you a plot synopsis. So, Mike?
A plot synopsis.
Synopsis of this book. So what's this book about?
Well, it takes place during the British Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 1400s?
No, 1640, 50?
Something like that.
Yeah.
So the style's written as if it was this person's approximation of how people would have sounded writing back.
Yeah, exactly.
Then. It was written in the 1900s.
Yeah, it was written probably in 1910, something like that.
I mean, the basic plot is that there's the main character whose name is Philip.
Sure. Oh my God, I've forgotten his name.
I know, me too. I think it's Philip.
We'll call him Sir Narrator.
And the narrator is basically has stayed out of the either side of the Civil War. He has managed to somehow.
He's not with the Puritans. Neutral. Yeah, he's not with the Puritans. He's not with the King, King Charles.
He gets a, but he's related to a nobleman.
Mm-hmm.
Who owns, a property and a castle and mm-hmm. an award or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And he gets contacted by the people, his peasants or his, his the land, leasers.
Yeah. His, well, basically his serfs.
His serfs.
Yeah. Who, in the town of Marsham,
mm-hmm. to come and negotiate some problems between the nobleman and the townspeople.
Yeah. So the nobleman has apparently he has gone to war on the side of the king and has become rather belligerent. He's appropriating whatever he wants. He's taking whatever he wants from the peasantry and leaving them with no food, no cattle, and even worse, he's like, you know, pressing them into service. He's taking the women and forcing them into...
What's his name?
His name is... Blast. I just read this like a week and a half ago.
I know.
He's the
names
guy.
Aren't important.
Who are the who are the name? What are name? What's
he's
the name?
He's the Earl of the Hold of the Deeping Hold.
Of the Earl of the he's the Earl of the Deeping Hold. Yeah.
Hubert. Hubert is the main character.
Yeah. Hubert. Hubert and is it Philip?
There's a guy named Philip in here somewhere.
You keep paging, I'll keep vamping.
Okay.
They
call him the Earl.
Yeah, the Earl. And he...
Or dear cousin.
He has sort of ravaged this town, and the leader of the town has come to contact this cousin to say, hey, you know, you can talk to this guy, you know, talk some reason into him, you know, rein him in, he's ruining our town.
Right.
And he agrees to do this. And he journeys to meet the Earl and is taken into custody immediately and sort of whisked away because the Roundheads, the Puritans, are making gains. Oliver Cromwell, as we know, wins this war. This guy is doomed, we know, at the beginning.
The Earl is doomed.
The Earl is doomed, yeah. And so we know, and so he retreats to his castle, his keep, which is sort of in this marsh, sort of a salty marsh that leads out to the sea, brings our negotiator, our narrator, with him. And that's where events unfold.
Yes. There's a cast of characters that are already in the castle.
Yeah.
Well, we find out that the Earl, mm-hmm. his wife, has died. Mm-hmm. And most likely has been murdered.
Most likely has been murdered. He has a doxy, who is the Italian woman.
He has a and then there's the cousin of his wife, or the sister.
Yes,
the
dear Rosamund.
Sister. Yeah,
Rosamund, who is a chaste and virtuous noble woman.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the Swede.
The Swede, and who is the head of the, like, sort of like the mercenary head of his armed forces. Right.
And then there's the black, Pompey.
Oh, Pompey, yeah. Pompey. Yes. Oh, dear. And, yeah, this is
written. He's hardly even featured.
He's hardly even featured, but when he shows up on the stage, you're like, oh boy, was this written in 1914.
And then there's the leader of the, the sort of the townspeople.
Yeah, the town of Marsham. But the main feature of the story is actually, they talk about it in the title. It's the hole of the pit.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a curse.
Yeah, the story is actually kind of setting-based. Setting really, really makes a difference here. It's really spooky. You have this spooky castle. It's on this
creepy marsh.
You have this creepy marsh, and in the middle of the marsh is this lake. And in the lake, there's
seaweedy lake.
Yeah, it's stinks. Yeah, in the middle of the lake, there's this deep, deep depression, and there's something in this deep, deep part of the lake, kind of like the Loch Ness monster. But
we don't. You don't really know.
You don't really know. But there's a curse that's attached to it. Something about in the past, a previous Earl of the Deeping Hold has evoked the curse and was punished by whatever it is that lives in the hole. And if the creature is aroused again, it'll destroy the Earl and end the line.
When the Lord of the Deeping Hold to the fiend his soul hath sold and hath awakened what doth sit in the darkness of the pit, then what doth sit beneath the hole shall come and take him body and soul.
Hmm.
And that's basically it. That's the story right there.
That's
basically.
It. Basically, pretty much.
And this thing is awakened by what?
Well, by the Earl, because the Earl tempts fate. He takes the
town's leader.
Yeah,
and throws him into the pit.
Yeah, basically. And he is devoured by something. And you never get a clear look at it. You get hints. For all the world, it's the blob. Well, it's about as close as you get to see. It's some sort of like gigantic brown stinking amoeba.
Maybe.
Yeah. That's actually one of the virtues of the book. You don't ever really get a good
clear. All you know is it produces slime, but you don't know if it's slime itself.
Yeah.
You just see it.
And it's sneaky.
Mm-hmm.
It masquerades once in a while. It'll masquerade as the tide coming in.
Right.
Or as a whirlpool. Or as
part of the marsh. Or,
yeah. And you can always, I mean, the writer always kind of telegraphs, you always kind of know when it's coming because it smells. It has a particular smell. And the narrator always gives you that little hint that, you know it's coming.
So they throw the dude into the lake and there's this bubbling. And then up comes his armor, and there's nothing.
Yeah, which is weird.
Except a foot.
Because you'd think that the armor, you know, it being metal and all, would just sink. But
maybe he just it's like a crack.
The creature. The creature kind of makes sure it gets delivered back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He like sucked out the.
Yeah. Like the meat out of a claw. Exactly. Meat out of a lobster claw. And puts the claw back. It's like, I'm done. Game on. Let's go. Mm-hmm.
So you have that going on, but then you have these people who are sort of now sort of imprisoned by the Earl himself.
Yeah, the Earl's keeping
the Earl's
there.
Insanity.
Yeah.
And also by the marsh and by the creature. So they're.
And also. By the armed forces that are getting closer.
So there's like three things that are keeping. So you have that dynamic going mm-hmm. on as well. This is people sort of kept close, and imprisoned, and their minds and their own torturous goings on. So you have that, and then you have this creature, and then you have the insanity, of. Everyone, and basically.
Pretty much everyone, but the Earl himself is clearly the leader of the insanity. But his mercenaries, like the Swede, is clearly is pretty corrupt. He's not really insane, but he realizes more and more that he's hitched his wagon to the wrong horse, and he starts to lose a little bit.
He's a
turncoat. Yeah, he's a mercenary. His paycheck's about to run out. So
then should we just hit the high points? Like what happens?
Yeah. So they end up. So they meet and they retreat to the castle. And they arouse the beast by taunting it and
feeding it an appetizer.
Giving it an appetizer. And which is a pretty horrible scene because you kind of know this guy. You know, he's
a pretty good guy.
He's a pretty good guy, yeah. And
the Earl's just going batshit at that point.
Yeah. So. And so they retreat to the castle, and in the castle, intrigues are underway. You have the Earl is losing his mind. He is under the thumb of his paramour, the Italian woman or the Italian witch, which is
so cliche.
I know, it's fantastic. Actually,
only the dark forces come through the Mediterranean.
Yes, but do you know where these dark forces specifically come from? They're dark Catholic forces. Catholic forces. it's pure turn of the century British anti-Catholicism.
Or pro-Catholicism, depending on which way you look at it.
Because
she's the only one that really tries to do something.
Yeah, she does, but everything she tries to do is to serve herself.
Oh, yeah.
Always. I mean, she actually could. She tries things that you're led to believe actually could have probably worked.
Except but people keep screwing it up.
Yeah, they get kind of...
The British keep screwing it up, basically.
Stupid Brits.
She performs a ritual pretty
gruesome.
Yeah, pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And it's almost like the spirit of this thing is present.
Yes.
And but it goes horribly wrong.
Yeah, it goes
because everybody leaves their circles.
And, yeah. Yeah, it goes wrong. And
but boy, what a prototype. Well, anyway, we'll talk more about that.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, so they're trying, in a way, they try to take on. They're having to take on the Earl.
Mm-hmm.
They're having to take on the Dark Force.
The Dark Force.
And then they're having to kind of take on each other because
they're all fracturing.
Yeah.
They got one against each other. Little alliances get formed. There's only one alliance that gets formed and stays, and that's our love interest. Our narrator finds the virtuous British woman, Rosamund. And you can see that coming from a mile away. And they, of course, end up together. And he protects her and she protects him. But one by one, the soldiers, when they move into the keep, there's probably, I don't know, 40, 50 men. And by the time you get to the end, you're down to like four or five and they just get picked off.
Yeah. It's
like an Agatha Christie novel or a Friday the 13th movie at the end there.
Or them.
Yeah.
Or they.
They. But, and this is the point I think you're about to make. This was written in 1914 or published in 1914. Way before Agatha Christie.
Wait, before we get into that, though, let's just say what happens. Because we might as well finish the story, basically.
Yeah, so they all get picked
up. But there's a bunch of, there's some sword fights, and there's intrigues, and there's poisonings, and there's...
And there's some
and really, everybody's trying to save their skin.
Yeah, and there's some creepy little bits where the monster finds new ways of getting into the keep
and is getting closer in and pulling people in.
Just plucks people out of hallways and stuff like that. And it's pretty creepy.
And pretty soon people are basically kept in one room. I mean, the castle, they are under siege.
They're under siege.
By this creature.
Yeah, and at the same time, the Earl is insisting on keeping up this air of good living.
Right, so they're eating these meals.
Yeah, and drinking good wine. They're
getting more and more stanky.
I know. It's kind of
like down to like dried bread and
It's kind of like raisins. It's kind of like the Mask of the Red Death, where they just they retreat into this place and it's like, the world is falling apart around us, but we're drinking the best wine.
Weird 70s party or something.
Weird 70s
party. They can't leave because it's like a lock-in.
I know, and they all have to drop their keys in the fishbowl.
And, but his, he also has in the basement of the castle a keep of gunpowder or explosives.
That's right.
And in the end, the Earl just takes down the castle.
Yeah.
It explodes, and I couldn't tell, but I think the Italian dies, and he dies. Yep,
and he dies, and our hero and heroine, our narrator and his wife-to-be, as we find out at the very end, Rosamund, do escape. I mean, it's just a blur at
the end. And is the creature dead? We don't know.
We don't know. But
the creature's in the castle.
Yeah, but the curse has been fulfilled.
Yeah, because the creature took the...
Yeah, so the upshot is that you're led to believe that that the creature is done with its work now, and
the marshes smell fresh again.
Yeah. fresh marshy smells.
So that's the basic story.
That's the basic story.
Yeah. Now you would think, well, yeah, you go, well, we've heard that story a gazillion times.
You have. But in 1914, you haven't.
I wonder if you've heard that story in 1914.
I don't know that you have. Now, some of this story, it definitely has the flavor of the old Gothic romances, the Anne Radcliffe, the Horace Walpole.
I'm also thinking 1914. You've got that whole spiritualism going on.
Spiritualism.
You've got sort of those parlor intrigues where people are. And that's definitely going on.
Yeah.
I was saying this book reminded me a lot of The Haunting of
Hill House. Yeah. Yeah.
Where people are sort of trapped in that space and they have to encounter.
Yeah. And this book.
And it's about the two things. It's about the encounter with these forces and the encounters with each other.
Yeah.
And that's going on at the same time.
Yeah, the thing that surprised me about this book was that the characterization. Now, some of the characterization was kind of thin, but for the most part, there was a good half dozen of pretty vibrant characters in this. Many of the characters have aspects of being types, of being stereotypes. You know, of course, the African is. Horrible stereotype.
He's not an African.
He's a Moor. The Swede.
I didn't think he was that stereotyped, quite frankly. So I'm kind of surprised at how.
Really?
Yeah. Because he hardly speaks.
Yeah, but when he speaks, he's all.
He's not. No, not really. He's more kind of Moorish.
Yeah, I suppose you're right.
I'm usually sensitive to those things, and I was like, I don't know what you were talking about.
I think it'd be pretty easy for somebody who is looking to be offended to be really offended.
I was more offended as an Italian-American.
As an Italian-American and having been raised Catholic.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, totally. But the wicked Italian is absolutely a stock
character. She's a great character.
She's a great character. She may have been my favorite character. I don't know, actually, the Earl, the crazy Earl, was my favorite character. Watching him, dueling, those duels where they were practicing, but then they weren't practicing. Those are great scenes.
The other thing is, I mean, they're confined by the house, they're confined by the creature, they're confined by the war, and then they're confined by convention.
Yes.
Because this Hubert, he gets into these duels because he's, like, obligated.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I mean, if that was today, I mean, I don't know. Would you? Yeah.
But he's
the Earl.
Exactly. And he's writing about he's writing about 17th century society and dueling.
As he thinks it went.
And dueling was an aspect of that. That carried over into America. I mean, Alexander Hamilton died in a duel. Mm-hmm.
Right.
That kind of honor dueling. Mm-hmm. So what did you think about the attempt to write in that style?
What did I think about it? Yeah. I'll tell you about my experience. At first I was like, oh shit, not another one of these. and
it can be tough.
But like I said to you on the phone, it was sort of like reading Shakespeare. You just have to enter into it.
Yes.
And eventually there's a rhythm to it and you can understand what's going on. But, you know, I was thinking about the author's choice about why did you decide to write it like that.
Yeah.
But it's really sort of this recollection from Hubert's point of view. It's sort of like his memoir, his diary.
It's supposed to be his memoir. Yeah, exactly.
So it's like this old document.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to get in the way of things, the suspense of things, and and it really didn't.
Yeah, you know, I also had my doubts. I'll get into this a little bit later, but there's another writer that was writing right around this time, another horror writer named William Hope Hodgson, who has this gigantic sort of dark fantasy novel before there was ever such a thing called The Nightland, which is a brilliant idea that is completely, completely mangled by his choice to write it in this kind of dialect. I mean, it's almost, there's parts of it that are almost unreadable because the dialect.
You're like, what the hell are they talking about?
What are they talking about? And then you're saying, why are you talking about it like this? Why did you decide to do it this way? Anyway, and I was really afraid when I started reading this, like, oh my God, this is going to be like The Nightland. And it wasn't. And the moment when I thought that it really wasn't, when I was actually impressed by this guy's ability to write, were those sword fighting scenes where they were actually very exciting to read.
Mm-hmm, they were.
And it's hard to write a sword fight and describe an exciting sword fight in the King's English.
And plus from first person.
Yeah, yeah. And he pulled it off, and I was very impressed. I was very impressed. So I have to say, you know, this book, if you have to, give it a chance. I'd say three chapters. You have to just sort of bull your way through the first three chapters, read it out loud.
Yeah, because the first three are really exposition.
Yeah.
It gives you a historical sense of what's happening.
Yeah, you have to get to that. You have to get into where you meet the Earl and get to the castle, and after that is pretty exciting. But those first three chapters can be a bit of a slog, and I recommend that you actually practice like reading it out loud, which is what I did. I ended up actually reading about a good half of this book to myself out loud with my poodle sitting on my lap looking at me, wondering who I was talking to. And it really worked.
Which is disturbing in and of itself.
Yeah, I know.
I didn't do that. I just read it in my head, and it worked out just fine. I didn't need poodles or...
I didn't need the
poodle. Didn't need drama. I just needed to say, okay, I'm going to read it.
Mm-hmm.
I just used my will.
You just used your will.
And it worked. I just stopped. Don't fight.
Yeah, don't fight it. Don't fight it.
Because this will be pure hell for the next 3 days if you fight it. Mm-hmm. And it's just like going to see Shakespeare. The first 10 minutes of a Shakespeare play, your mind is trying to twist around, what the hell? And then somehow your right brain takes over.
Yeah.
It really is the fight between your left brain and your right brain. Because your left brain is
going,
we don't know what this is. And your right brain is just like, shut the fuck up.
Just listen.
And just listen.
Yeah.
And then it becomes a story.
Yeah. I know. It's weird. I mean, that experience happens to me whenever I read something from, not the 20th century. You have to do that.
Have to do it with Voyage to Arcturus, and it was hard at first.
In what?
Voyage to Arcturus.
Oh, Arcturus, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we really did. That was actually pretty tough at the
beginning. That was tough in the beginning.
Yeah. Eventually you sort of give into it. I have another interesting anecdote. So you can't see in this book, but this book is dedicated to somebody. In our edition, the dedication isn't carried over, but it was originally dedicated to M.R. James, who was a friend of Adrian Ross's. M.R. James, we've spoken about him before on the podcast, was the very well-respected ghost story writer from this time. He wrote from the 1880s, 70s or so until, I don't know, like 1910, 1920, thereabouts. And there are elements of the story that are very M.R. Jamesian. Specifically, all of M.R. James's ghost stories, his most famous book is called Ghost Stories of an Antiquary, or an Antiquary. And they all start with somebody finding something in a library. And that's how this book starts. He finds that little poem we read earlier about the curse. That was from a book that he finds in his library. And that's a very M.R. Jamesian thing.
Yeah, it was an accidental thing, too.
Yeah.
There's a book behind the book.
Totally an M.R. James conceit. But the rest of this book is not at all like M.R. James. M.R. James's books are very
intellectual. Lots of Latin, lots of French, lots of footnotes that he puts in, and then ones that like later editors have to put in to explain the footnotes.
Let's never ever read them.
Yeah. Actually, I just read the entirety of the Ghost Stories of an Antiquary.
Mm.
They weren't bad,
mm.
but they take some work. A lot more work than this one did, which is saying something.
Who were the contemporary? Who else would have been the contemporary of this author? Is any like Oscar Wilde was a contemporary,
an absolute contemporary. Well, we haven't actually talked about this author. This author is actually a very interesting person. He was very famous in his.
He's like a Renaissance man,
kind of. Well, he started. He
does a lot.
He did a lot. Thing. Yeah, he was an Oxford Don. He was a he was a lecturer, a Don at Oxford University, and he eventually resigned that position because he found a great deal of success writing lyrics.
For operettas and musicals.
For operettas and musicals, exactly. He was...
And he has a ton of them. I mean...
Like 200 operettas. I mean, it's insane how many operettas... I mean, his lyrics, he has thousands of songs that he wrote lyrics for.
Yeah. He's a poet, yeah.
He's writing in the sort of the generation after Gilbert and Sullivan. But he was, I mean, his operettas, he was involved in operettas that were actually put on at the Savoy Theatre. And other theaters around London, so these light comic operas with soldiers and maidens and singing about modern major generals, that's what he wrote, and he was actually a pretty famous guy in his day. He's forgotten now, but later in his career,
this is his only novel, isn't it?
He wrote this one novel, and it's mind-blowing that he would write a novel like this
and then stop.
This is his only published piece of fiction. He's like the Harper Lee of the novel, I'm sure, got published. It probably wasn't particularly impressive to his publishers, but he was a famous guy. This is like if Jerry Seinfeld right now decided to write a novel or Eminem decided to write a horror novel, you can bet it would get published.
Yeah.
But a second one probably would not be. and that was, I imagine that's kind of what the situation was with this.
And who knows? Maybe there is a second one out there. We just don't know about
it. Yeah, we just don't know.
Who knows? I mean, just got lost in history somewhere.
It's entirely possible. But yeah, he was a pretty famous guy, but he was famous for light comic opera lyrics. His most famous, his only really work that really endures today is... he wrote the English, the English translation of a German, Swedish, I don't know. Edvard Grieg wrote an opera called The Merry Widow, and he did the English version of it. And so when you Google Adrian Ross song now, you'll find The Merry Widow. And that's pretty much it. However, I am pleased to say that my colleague Mike here has found a little treat for us at the end of the podcast.
Yes.
You'll have to introduce it. To the end.
All right. Yeah.
That's who this guy was, which is makes this book even more delicious to me because it's so out of left field, even for its time, but even for like its author.
Would Poe have been after him?
Poe was before him. Poe was
before him. Shelley was before him.
Way before him.
A
good 100 years before him.
And it does have that. I mean, it still has some of those same conceits,
Yeah, I mean, his immediate contemporaries are M.R. James, who was his friend, William Hope Hodgson, who I've said I was going to talk about him before. This story very much reminds me of a William Hope Hodgson story.
They mention him in the intro here, too.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Hodgson's most famous story called The House on the Borderland. Hodgson also wrote some stories about ghost stories about the sea, which I've never read, but this might have something to do with that. One's called The Ghost Pirates, and the other one's called The Boats of the Glengarrig.
Boats of Glenlivet.
Of Glenlivet. but he also has a series of stories called Carnacki the Ghost Finder, which, I don't know, that might have something to do with it, too.
That'd be kind of cool.
Those are findable. Those are in print. I mean, all of his books are in print. But William Hope Hodgson died in the he died in the trenches of World War One at the age of late 20s, early 30s. Plus, he wrote that book, The Nightland, which is a work of genius that is horribly, horribly flawed by a very bad decision.
I wonder if anybody ever tried to rewrite that book in the vernacular.
The Nightland?
Yeah.
You know, I wonder.
I could see somebody like Clive Barker doing that. Or...
It's possible. The Nightland is a kind of a science fiction novel. It takes place after the sun has gone dark. It's on Earth, and all of humanity lives in this one. It's called the Redoubt. It's like this pyramid. And there's another pyramid on the other, like far away from the original pyramid. And this guy has this dream about his loved one, and he has to like cross the Nightland to get to that other pyramid. And the Nightland is inhabited by unspeakable horrors.
Hmm.
And it's just a narration about his journey across from one Redoubt to the other one.
Hmm.
And it's a great idea that it's just, I mean, the first thing he does is just shoot himself in the foot. I made it through it. But I can't recommend anybody ever read it because it's just not worth it. It's just not worth it. However, the House on the Borderland is a ripping read. It's pretty cool. So anyway, but this book kind of reminds me more, and actually Ramsey Campbell, the editor of this book, says it reminds him more of William Hope Hodgson. Maybe Adrian Ross read Hodgson, maybe not. Who knows?
Yeah.
They knew each other.
It's possible. I mean, Hodgson was kind of a. I mean, it's possible. It's possible. There's not really. Nobody's done the research, and I'm not going to. So, other contemporaries. There's Algernon Blackwood. There's Lord Dunsany.
Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Edgar Rice Burroughs is writing at this time. Sax Rohmer is writing at this time. The Fu Manchu stories.
Voyage to Arcturus.
Voyage to Arcturus was written. No, that was written in 23, 26.
So not that far.
Yeah, Lovecraft was writing his very first stories at this time. But there's no evidence that Lovecraft ever read the story. Lovecraft would love this story.
Well, I was going to say this reminded me. The creature reminded me of a Lovecraftian creature.
Totally. Another writer, Arthur Machen. But there's lots. There's a lot of writers at this time. This is before. But all these writers, these writers weren't genre writers. These writers were getting published in, you know, major magazines. These were just novels. They weren't like horror novels.
I guess the reason I'm asking this is like, I kind of want to give him credit for developing certain themes that you see in every freaking horror.
Yeah.
Psychological. I mean, this is a psychological horror in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, and it's sophisticated that way, I think, which surprised me.
It is sophisticated.
But I wanted to give him credit for that. And then I'm thinking, well, maybe that's just what was going on
at
that time. You know, I mean, Freud, 1910.
Yeah. I mean, you're tempted to give him credit for it. But honestly, there's no evidence that many people ever read this book. I mean, like I said, Lovecraft, there's no evidence that Lovecraft was aware of this book. And Lovecraft made it a point to be aware of all of these kinds of books.
Either it was something that he developed and it was just a time. I mean, that was all being talked about in that time. And so he's just part of that time.
Yeah.
Or he was a little bit ahead of his time, but you can see elements of what he does in so many things.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You wonder who else has read this book. Well, true.
Apparently nobody. Well, you and I.
Yeah.
And Ramsey Campbell.
Yeah. Maybe Shirley Jackson read this book.
It's possible. You know, it's very curious. It's kind of a rabbit hole. When you try to ask these questions, like who influenced who, you know, try to find evidence that, you know, such and such a person read this book and therefore must have been influenced by it. Sometimes you can find evidence, but most of the time
things don't work that way.
It just kind of, things don't work that way. It just gets in the air. It's just in the air.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's that,
And it does because it's, you know, you've got the parlor mystery and you've got the spiritualism, the spiritism, and you've got the discovery of creatures and you've got, you know, all that you know, impending war and all that stuff. So
and these kind of stories are they're particularly a British tradition. I think we talked about this in the past when we talked about A Christmas Carol. That ghost stories are just like scary stories like this are just they're very English. There's something that the English loved all through the 19th century and into the 20th century. And this is a late flowering of it.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe this is something that he told on Christmas Eve. That was a British tradition to tell ghost stories on Christmas Eve.
Or maybe it's based on some legend somewhere.
It's possible. The legends of the Loch Ness Monster were around at this time. So maybe he's keying off of that. There's a very Loch Ness Monster-y sort of thing going on about the story.
Loch Ness Monster never hurt anybody.
Well, no, but the idea that it's this creature living in this deep lake or loch.
It didn't take place in Scotland.
It sure didn't. Anyway, who knows? Who knows? I mean, we know so little about what was going on with this book. It's kind of a mystery. Nobody has paid attention to it.
Yeah. And people should pay attention to it.
So here we are evangelizing this book, Adrian Ross, The Hole of the Pit.
I did want to read something that I really liked.
All right.
There's an exchange going on between the Italian and Hubert.
Yes.
And Hubert's very religious and is very honorable and moral, and he's sort of it's sort of like Goldman and Narcissus from Hermann Hesse. You've got one person that experiences the world through sort of rigid accounting of rules and dogma and following the straight line, and you've got the other person who sort of experiences the world through much more chaos and darkness, but they both end up in the same place.
Yes.
So, which would be a good... anyhow, there's this exchange because she's wanting to do something about... She's saying, I think I could do something about this creature.
Yeah, she has ideas. She knows.
She wants to take it on. So he says, I know of no arm but prayer and no help but the Almighty, I said, doffing my hat. I knew you would say that, she answered softly, yet with scornfulness in her voice. You Puritani are ever in one story. Which I love that line.
You are ever in one story.
But the Almighty,
you have to do sort of a Sophia Loren.
But the Almighty is far away, and I have seen the good men cry out for help and perish as one of the wicked. There be other spirits, not Almighty, yet assuredly potent. They are nearer to help if one knows their speech.
That's such a Catholic thing to say.
And I was about to tell her that I had no faith in invocation of saints, but at the word she caught me up scornfully. Dio mio, what? To dance you English are. Nay, I speak of others than saints, though perchance they mask themselves saintly. Think you that I would pray for help to the rotten bones of a stupid friar that would rub out the wisdom of the ancients to have parchment for the jargon he called Latin? I have better helpers than saints, as you shall see, if you be not afeard. I will have no dealings with devils, I said shortly, rising with a step. Who spake of devils? To the wise, there is no devil, no saint, but powers and intelligences that are mighty to help or hurt, perilous to compel, and deadly to fools and cowards, but answering to the right word. Much can I do alone, but not enough, Umberto. Wilt thou dare to help me? I loved that whole scene.
I remember reading that. I'm thinking,
I think I do have a copy of this. Yeah. I think in just that line, you live in one story.
Yeah.
I think is an amazing, I'm getting all excited. I think it's amazing vision into human nature.
Yes.
And what makes people stuck and what keeps us trapped and not being able to try to take, and she probably could have taken care of the business.
Yes, she could. Yes, I think we're allowed to believe that she actually should have taken care of it.
Their own fear and their own sort of uncomfortableness and their morality, whatever. Yeah,
their morality.
They made it worse.
Yes, they did. And I mean, ultimately, we are allowed to believe that she's self-serving and that her design is to basically better her own lot and end up with the more powerful person. She's sort of she wants to preserve her own skin first and foremost. But in the preserving of her own skin, she is looking at the tools and she can actually see what can be done in the world. She's okay. Ultimately practical.
But interestingly enough, they all want to preserve their own skin.
But she actually can do it.
But he cloaks that in his
piety.
His piety and his, you know, everyone's protecting their own skin.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting that she's seen as more devilish.
I know.
Just because she's more.
Yeah. But she's more competent. she's way more competent. I mean, in the end, Hubert is, he's his piety wills out, but it's pure luck.
It's yes.
It is pure luck.
Yeah.
She can accurately assess the situation. She has no illusions. Given the proper tools and the working of them, she could have solved it, halfway through the book.
Well, I think that now that we're talking about this, I'm thinking that in a way, Hubert, he takes great pride in not picking sides.
Yes.
And, that may have saved his skin,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't make for an interesting life for him in a way.
No.
And all through the book, he's sort of being pushed to pick a side.
Yeah.
You know, are you going to side with the villagers? Are you going to side with the Earl? Are you going to side
with the king?
Are you going to side with darkness? Are you going to side with
Cromwell? Yeah.
Yeah. How are you going to?
And he never does.
He never does.
He never does.
He never does, which leaves him more open to the whims of fate.
Yeah.
Than.
Yeah.
And, and I'm thinking, well, at least she kind of went down in a blaze of glory or something.
Yeah. I mean, she doesn't really pick sides either.
She picks
her own side.
Right. Yeah. She does pick a side.
But so does he.
Yeah.
But he
acts like he's not picking a side.
Yeah, he cloaks it in piety. And she's just like, she's just purely practical.
I'm going to pick a side.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to,
check a box.
Yeah. I'm going to check a box.
Yeah.
And it's going to be me.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, she was a great character. And, I was a little sad to see her go.
Yeah. Well, we don't really know if she's...
You don't know.
You don't really know because they don't... She's sort of... The last few pages, she's sort of... You're like... She's kind of not around.
Yeah.
Like, what happened to her?
Yeah. So, we're getting on here. I'm thinking, before it gets too late, we should formulate our formula.
What are you talking about?
Our cocktail.
Oh, cocktail time.
It's cocktail time. We've given this lots of thought. So
we have.
We actually have.
For us.
I mean, we just gave it lots of thought. But this is a winner. Folks, this is a winner.
And you can check it out in our upcoming cocktail book called Forbidden Cocktails.
Forbidden Cocktails. Necronomishots.
I like that.
All right. Necronomishots. Here it is. And this is our Necronomishot. What are we going to call this one?
It's called Salt Marsh.
The Salt Marsh. What's in the Salt Marsh, Mike?
Well, the first thing you do is you take a shot glass. You see? And you rim it with some good Fleur de Sel.
Fleur de Sel, yeah.
Yeah.
The nicest salt you can get.
The best salt, because you want good salt.
Yeah, because salt makes a difference.
Right. And then you get an olive, a nice green olive, not with the pimento, but with a hole in it.
With a hole in it.
And you stuff some
Stilton cheese.
Yeah, cut a little wedge and shove it in there.
It's jam that sucker right in there.
Make sure it's really stinky.
Drop it in the bottom of the shot.
And you pour in some nice smoky
scotch. Single malt scotch, if you have this laying around. I recommend Lagavulin or Laphroaig. Very, very smoky and peaty. It smells kind of marshy. And there you have it. You just take that and you
suck it down.
You drop that down. Be careful. Please be careful not to choke on the olive.
This is what I was afraid of, and then we're going to get sued. All these people are dying of olive,
olive
stuffed in their gullets.
Yeah. Darwin will out. Natural selection is what I say.
Yeah. And it's all part of the horror.
Yeah, that's all part of the horror. It's the fulfillment of the curse of the salt marsh shot.
So yeah, let's chuck it down. And I'd recommend doing two or three of them.
Two or three of them, yeah. I mean, because you know, it's you know, one is just an appetizer, but three, that's a meal.
And I would also recommend getting those little plastic swords that you.
Oh yeah, and then duel.
And then do a little duel.
Dual dueling. Yeah, we can just you can tip the swords with cocktail
onions. A rapier.
Yeah, you can tip the swords with cocktail onions, and then you when it gets serious, you take the onion off.
Draw some blood.
Yeah. So there you have it.
Salt marsh. Glug glug. Well, there we go. That we're back from our adventure in cocktails. Well, what else about this book?
What would be
an interesting question that we could ask ourselves about this book?
Why is this book was this book forgotten?
Oh,
I could think of a couple of reasons, but you know, I mean, why is anything forgotten? I mean, I have you know, in my tastes in horror and science fiction novels and music, I like lots of obscure things, and you know, why are they forgotten? Who knows?
I have a theory.
Yeah,
I have two theories.
All right.
One theory is this: he was known for a certain type of work.
Yes.
And so when people are kind of pigeonholed into something, it's very unusual for them to be able to cross.
Yeah, that's
genres.
That's the only theory I could come up with.
The second thing is he only did one of them,
and that
when you only do one. Then it's easier to get lost if he had done six.
Yeah, it was sort of an aberration in his career. And people was like, well, yeah, I mean, he was this great lyricist, and he did this horror novel, and it's not really not my thing.
But even as a lyricist, is he forgotten? I mean, there's somebody like you and I, maybe, but I don't know. People in music, maybe they know him.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, I guess I know some people who are, you know, pretty into the musical theater, and I actually mentioned his name to a couple of these people, and they've never heard of him. Never heard of them.
Well, but that's, I mean, you're talking about a genre of musical theater. I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's essentially.
It's the 19th. What else is remembered? Dead. What's remembered from the 1914s?
Very little. Because that's kind of the musical theater. People remember Gilbert and Sullivan. They remember opera, you know, like Italian and French and German opera. They remember Gilbert and Sullivan in English opera. And then there's this dark period where apparently nothing ever happened. Well, we know something happened.
Tons of things were happening.
Adrian Ross was in that period. Yeah. And then and vaudeville came along. And then American musical theater took precedence. You had Showboat. And then you had Rodgers and Hammerstein.
But that stuff. Yeah, but that was
the 30s, 40s, and 50s. Right. Actually, Showboat was, what, 38? Something like that. Yeah.
Until then, it was all sort of like this.
Yeah, it was just
body house kind of.
Yeah, it was cobbled together. You know, just you know, you have stock characters, stock plots,
and like Commedia dell'arte or something.
Yeah, and you know, and they're very light, very fluffy, very clever lyrics, and they were forgotten.
And perhaps forbidden,
and so was Adrian Ross. He was forgotten.
I'm glad we're remembering him.
But we're remembering
him
today.
I'd like to do a toast to Adrian Ross.
Here's Adrian Ross. Chin chin.
Yip yip.
Yip yip. those 2 points, those are the two reasons I can think of.
So what do you think this book contributes to horror?
The history of horror? Nothing. Honestly. Seriously. Because it's kind of this aberration.
Well, okay,
but the history of horror going forward, I think a lot. If people remember this book deserves to be read. Deserves to be read by a lot of people. And I think its contribution is yet to come. I'm going to say that because I don't think anybody read it. Nobody. I mean, I'd be surprised if Clive Barker read this book. I'd be surprised if Stephen King has read it.
I bet Stephen King has read it.
You know, maybe. I wouldn't like die.
I don't think Anne Rice didn't read it.
Yeah. but you know, when these people were young writers starting out, they did not write. Yeah, they did not read it. So, you know, what is this contribution to the history of horror?
Nothing.
Minimal. Yeah, yeah. Very minimal.
What do you wish it would, its contribution would have been?
I wish, honestly, I wish this had crossed H.P. Lovecraft's desk. If he had read this book, this would be absolutely seminal to the history of horror. It probably would not have been out of print since 1935.
I want to say that he didn't write in a vacuum. He was probably picking up on the zeitgeist of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's condensed here in his story.
Okay.
But probably all those elements and all those things were around. Of course they were.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, he used them.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever, it was forgotten. But those elements, there was something going, I want to say that there was something going on in that time that was really foundational to horror.
Sure.
Now.
Sure.
And, you know, the idea of, I think the one idea is of those dark rituals,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
that these sort of spirit, that whole medium thing, mm-hmm, that whole spiritism, sure, okay, thing, that unnamed creature that,
yeah,
is kind of stalking you, mm-hmm, for its own reasons.
Yeah, unfathomable. Yeah, unfathomable reasons. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, think about the war,
which is
was
not that far in the future, but wasn't really on the horizon yet. People in 1914.
But there was warring going on.
Oh yeah, I mean it was lots of saber rattling all over the continent.
You know, I got to think that's going to be part of it. There's just something, a looming something that
Well, and one of the things that I find really interesting about it is
that people kind of suck.
People kind of suck. One of the things that I find so interesting about it is that, you know, this author is, is a very, very Edwardian, proper, upper class, scholarly British gentleman. And the tale is told from that point of view, but this tale is really gritty. It's not slasher
anything. Spider-punk.
Yeah, it's not spider-punk or anything like that. But it doesn't shy away from some pretty horrible scenes. I mean, when the
but people liked that back then. Like that.
They did.
You know, they went to hangings and shit. You know?
Yeah, that's true.
People liked that.
Yeah. Well, although Britain at this time was
Penny Dreadfuls.
But this isn't written for the audience, for the petty dreadful audience.
Well, okay, let's go back to a theme that we touched on earlier today.
All right.
It's the same thing. It wasn't. It's a penny dreadful written for a non-penny dreadful audience. So, just like Hubert or whatever his name was, was out for his own self, was cloaked in an air of respectability.
Yep.
That.
Yeah, I mean,
it wasn't published
in numbers like Penny Dreadfuls were, where they were published, like Dickens published his novels in like little sections. It was published as a complete work. Its audience, it was marketed. Maybe if it had been published as a Penny Dreadful,
it would have
taken root.
Yeah, because then the masses would have gotten
exactly. Yeah.
Poe did that too, right? I mean, that's how he published things.
Yeah, Poe published. I mean, he published one novel, but he published things in magazines, in literary magazines. Other writers who people think of as genre writers, like horror writers, like William Hope Hodgson and Algernon Blackwood, they publish in installments.
Pique people's curiosities.
Yeah. I mean, it's like quite a high wire act. Dickens, frequently was publishing the first parts of his novels when he didn't know how the novel was going to end.
Yeah.
That's gutty.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, Stephen King experimented with that with The Green Mile.
Right.
Which was also very gutty.
Yeah.
So, anyway, but this book was fully formed. It was published as a whole in 1914. So, that's actually a good insight. This is a Penny Dreadful published for a more patrician audience.
Mm-hmm. So which character were you drawn to?
I was most interested in the Italian, the Italian witch, and the Earl, because I liked the Italian witch's sanity, and I liked the Earl's insanity very much. So
Yeah, I think the Signora was
the Signora.
She was a good character.
She was,
and I was sort of drawn to that hand wench who was murdered, who died during the ritual.
Oh yeah, the Italian.
Well,
Italian.
And also there's that little thing of mesmerism going on, because she basically hypnotizes the girl. And
yep.
I like those characters that are the throwaway characters on him.
Yeah, and the Swede doesn't have a lot to do, but he was actually pretty great, and he didn't speak in a Swedish accent at all.
Not at all.
Anyway,
he was the Swede.
The Swede, yeah, he was dissuaded. So,
I don't know. I don't have anything else to say about this book.
Yeah,
we have to read it.
We've talked it up and talked it down.
Yeah.
Well, actually,
there isn't anything I would talk down about it. No. Actually, I don't.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. So, yeah.
So
that's it. Right?
So there you have it.
So then there's some news.
Yeah. Well, sure, news. Yeah.
All right, different news.
This is probably old news to almost everybody, but I just wanted to point people in directions of Dr. Horrible and
Dr. Horrible's sing along blog.
If you haven't seen it, see it. Is it horror? Kinda.
A little bit. There's a mad scientist
and there's murder and mayhem.
Doogie Howser as a mad scientist. That's horrible.
Wonderful singer. Second is the short clip of Buffy the Vampire, the animated series.
Oh, on YouTube.
That's
how we got warmed up this evening. We watched that. That was probably
everyone has seen that too, but really... It just makes you sad for what would have been.
Yeah.
Why does Joss Whedon get so short shifted? Like he did with Firefly, like this, like they cut Angel off at the knees before Angel was done.
Wonder Woman never got off the ground.
Why do they not just let him do his thing and all will be well?
I think because it costs a lot of money. I know. I mean, you and I, we'd pay him his $3.
I'd pay it.
I'd pay that $3. But there's just that's just the two of us. That's what, $6? Yeah. Maybe $7. I'd go $3.50.
Well, yeah. He did Dr. Horrible's musical blog on a shoestring. He did that purposely to show that what he could do.
Yeah. Yeah.
With not a lot of money. And
I know. It's actually kind of miraculous because it's one of the most entertaining things I've seen.
It really is.
In a long time.
And do I have other bookish horror news? I think that's it. That's all I got.
What do I have?
Nothing.
Really nothing. Not a damn thing.
What we haven't done is gone down.
You going to make us go down there?
We're going down to the cellar, man, so stop your complaining.
All right, fine.
Put on your galoshes.
All right, wait. Hold it. Yeah, this is not for not flip-flops.
Because we got a little flooding this week.
No flip-flops.
Too much slime.
Let's go.
All right, here we are.
Well, so, okay. We keep going into these back far corners. Let's go up to the front to the new arrivals section.
I feel like running.
Let's go to the new arrivals.
But you know what? I don't know the name of the author. I do know the name of the book, but I don't know the name of the author. So,
okay.
What was his damn name again?
All right. No, his name is Mario Acevedo.
I want to say Acevedo.
A-C-E-V-E-D-O.
I think he's Italian. He thinks he's Mexican.
I don't know. Together we don't know. But we do know that if you go to your local bookstore, Barnes & Noble or Borders or what have you, at the very beginning of the sci-fi fantasy section, you will find this book. I have always seen it when I've gone to the store.
And it's called?
The Nymphos of Rocky Flats.
There you go.
It's a kind of a porny vampire story, it looks like.
And there's a sequel called...
X-rated Bloodsuckers.
X-rated Bloodsuckers. I happened to cross this at the
There's also a vampire Kama Sutra, just so you know.
Okay. I happened to cross this at the Half Price Bookstore, the sequel, and then I figured out what the first one was.
Uh-huh.
And then I called you and said, we should read this. And you're like, I've been meaning to bring this book up.
I've been seeing it.
And here it's been down here in the... Forbidden Books seller all this time.
All this time. Sitting there in the new arrival section. So we're going to pick it up and we're going to carry it upstairs.
Yep. And we'll read it. Maybe we even read it.
I think we should probably read it.
All right.
So with that,
let's get up here again.
And back into my flip-flops, and here we go.
in the warm, dry, Forbidden Book
Sort of my hip waders.
I'm looking forward to this reading this book, actually. Yeah,
I think it's going to be delightfully
rip-roaring.
Delightfully rip-roaring, yeah. Orangey. So,
But the question will be is it horror?
Oh, who cares? It's got vampires in it. That's close enough.
Cut off its head.
All right.
And at the end of this is a little ditty by the author of the book.
Uh-huh.
What's his name again?
Adrian Ross.
And it's from It's from the operetta or the musical called The Greek Slave. And the title of this song, a little scratchy at the beginning, is called Naughty Girl.
So enjoy.
Bye.
Bye. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that.